It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists with your host, Jill Dittmeyer, a journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. The call-in phone number is 317-788-3314. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
Hello, I'm Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
And we are doing that today, and we're doing it via Zoom. We still can't get back into our studios, but instead we've gathered our guests together via Zoom so we can share this conversation with all of you at home. And today we're talking about the art and science of the IU Precision Health Initiative Grand Challenge when it comes to breast cancer research. And our guests have some really groundbreaking new research and information to share with us. So Mark, why don't you introduce them to everyone?
Sure. We're really excited and to welcome two IU School of Medicine researchers, Dr. Milan Radovich and Dr. Brian Schneider. Welcome to both.
Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And we have with us Nadia Miller, who's the board president of Pink Forever, an empowerment and education support organization for minority women that face breast cancer. And Nadia is also a breast cancer survivor herself. Welcome, Nadia.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome. We're glad to have you here. Thanks. Well, doctors, we know that you recently published your research in JAMA Oncology about your findings, and it's new blood-based biomarkers that can help determine whether or not women with triple-negative breast cancer we'll see a return of the disease. Of course, it's much more than that, and that's why we have you here to explain to us a little bit about these new findings and why they're important.
So yeah, I'll start a little bit with the background, and then I'll talk to I'll let Dr. Radovich kind of share some of the findings. So we really focused this research on a type of breast cancer called triple negative breast cancer. And triple negative breast cancer accounts for about 20% of the patients who have breast cancer. And it's an important one for several reasons. One is it preferentially affects young women, preferentially affects African-American women. And it's also a disease without targets with a really tough prognosis. So with this type of breast cancer, we often will treat patients with some chemotherapy prior to the patient going to surgery. We do this so that we can see and actually watch the tumor shrink in size. And interestingly, what happens when that patient goes to surgery, about one in three of them will have complete decimation of their tumor. So the surgeon will remove the tumor, it's all dead scar tissue. And the good news for that patient is her cure rate is now about 90%.
Wow.
Importantly though, for the other two thirds of the population where there's still some live tumor when the surgeon removes it, even though all of the cancer is removed, it really portends a tough prognosis. So for this patient, despite the fact she's done really good chemotherapy and had surgery, her cure rate now drops to about 50%. So this is obviously, you know, both psychologically and, you know, I think emotionally really tough for that patient to now wonder what's going to happen. So we really wanted to really try to address this population and try to make things better. And I think that really sets the background for the work we presented and published recently.
Yeah, let me ask you one question in there. Just I probably am a little confused, and I would think some people are listening. What do you mean by triple negative?
Yeah, so triple negative, in my opinion, is kind of a derogatory term. So we think in terms of cancer of having drug targets, right? The real, you know, holy grail behind all of cancer is to find a beautiful target so we can use good personalized medicine. Two of the oldest targets in all of cancer are the estrogen receptor and the progesterone receptor. And these are simply markers that the tumor responds to and is fed by estrogen. So these are things we've known for many decades. In the 1990s, another important marker was discovered called HER2. And the reason HER2 is important is it's an important prognostic marker, meaning if you have it, you have a higher chance of dying. But more importantly, a drug has been discovered which really has turned around the outcomes for these patients, a drug that we call Herceptin that many patients who have breast cancer have heard of. So with the discovery of Herceptin and HER2, it left us with another group of patients, those that simply didn't have the estrogen receptor didn't have the progesterone receptor and didn't have HER2. And so it has been named triple negative breast cancer, but importantly, doesn't really speak to what they do have.
Right. So it's three things they don't have, but they still, like you said, a very large percentage still has a 50% risk, and that's really serious.
Right.
Dr. Radovich, you want to go on with then where that took us?
Oh, absolutely. And I think Dr. Schneider really set up the scenario really well, is that when you have these patients with triple negative breast cancer where the chemo did not melt the tumor away, we know these patients are high risk of their cancer coming back. But we don't know 100% which patients their cancer will come back and which ones will not. One of the things with triple negative breast cancer is we know that if it does relapse, it usually comes back within the first, especially 3 years, but even up to about 5 years, this cancer can come back. And when it comes to the patient perspective, you can imagine just the scary scenario that is. Some patients have described to us that every single headache or back pain or something they feel, lump, may be the cancer coming back. So it's a really scary situation where you live every day worried that this cancer is going to come back. Because when these cancers do come back, they come back, unfortunately, as really aggressive disease. It comes back typically where the cancer has now traveled to another organ. We call this stage 4 disease or metastatic disease. And unfortunately, this disease is not curable. Patients will succumb to the disease pretty rapidly after relapse. And so we embarked on a really neat clinical trial in about 2014, where we took a really innovative approach to attacking this high aggressive triple negative breast cancer, where we launched a clinical trial called BRE-12158. And what this trial did was take women who had triple negative breast cancer with residual disease after chemotherapy, and this time took that tumor and actually analyzed it genomically. Meaning we looked at the blueprint of the cancer to see if we could find an Achilles heel that we can match the right therapy to it to be able to attack it better. In this trial, we gave women a matched genomic therapy after their surgery to see if we could improve outcomes. One of the cool things that we actually planned ahead of time in this trial was that we drew a blood sample, a simple blood sample after surgery, where we analyzed the blood sample for the presence of tumor material in the circulation. It's actually called circulating tumor DNA. This is actually DNA that's shed from cancers that go into the circulation. And using some really sensitive genomic techniques, we were actually able to look for the presence of circulating tumor DNA in these women after surgery who are quote unquote technically disease free. You can't see the cancer, you can't detect it on a scan, but you've got this blood sample saying there's something floating around. And if we found this circulating tumor material in these women, unfortunately, those patients were really high risk of their cancer coming back. They relapsed. Conversely, if we did find this circulating tumor material, those women actually did really quite well, actually suggesting a population that had benefited from therapies that they received, and hopefully be one in the future where we can even look at de-escalating their therapy.
This blood test then be used for all patients with triple negative then?
Well, you know, it's a great question, is where does this go from here? And this is an amazingly rapidly evolving area of technology. You know, when Dr. Schneider and I first started doing genomics, let me back up real quick. In 2000, the first human genome was sequenced. It took 11 years and $3 billion to do that. And just like cell phone technology, it's gotten cheaper, faster, and smaller. And so even in the years that Dr. Schneider and I have been doing genomics, it's been amazing how quick we can do this now. And so one of the questions is this ready for prime time right now in the doctor's office to use a blood test to detect whether this cancer come back? And our opinion is it's not ready yet. We think that there is a future where this will be used regularly. But what it really does point to is helping identify a patient population who's really high risk of cancer and being able to point them to cutting-edge clinical trials to see if we can actually improve the outcomes for these patients versus just knowing that they're going to do bad.
Did this lie kind of undetected for a couple of reasons? One, you weren't seeing your normal, like you said, three negatives. You weren't seeing your normal markers. And then the other is because it was in a population that we know it's typically not. And this brings Nadia in a little more, but it has been typically ignored sometimes by normal medicine and that. And so, you know, we're dealing with a lot of African-American women, and that could have been part of why we didn't detect it as well. And so this sounds like an incredible breakthrough in the lives of women.
Yeah, and I'll give a couple of thoughts on the clinical perspective now, and I'd love to get Nadia's kind of, you know, input and her kind of philosophy and thoughts on how, you know, she reacts to this sort of thing. But You know, in my clinic, of course, now I'm getting a ton of patients asking me, okay, can I do the blood test now, right? I mean, that's the obvious question. The real problem with this is, you know, what I can tell a patient is, oh, good, you don't have circulating tumor DNA, so I think you're going to do really well. The problem is I don't know if that means she can skip additional therapy, right? Conversely, for the patients who do have it, I'm going to tell her really bad news. I think there's a really good chance this is going to come back. And so, you know, really what we want to embark on now is where can we use this information to be impactful? And that really, I think, requires us to design clinical trials for those who we think are going to do great. You know, let's start thinking about, can we study de-escalating and doing less therapy so that we can still give great cure rates, but avoid a lot of the side effects that we see with our therapies that we use? And conversely, for those patients who do have circulating tumor DNA, okay, how can we exploit this in a way where we can really use better therapies to make better outcomes? And I think once we have that, then we'll draw that tube of blood in clinic.
Yeah, where Nadia, where you come in, because recruiting women for these research studies is very important. And that's kind of where you as a cancer survivor and also as the Pink Forever group, you, or Pink Never, you have really stepped up to help with these studies, Nadia.
Yes, ma'am. And then also, I'm a breast cancer survivor, but I'm also a triple negative breast cancer survivor.
Oh.
So it this resonates with me a couple of different ways, from a personal perspective and a professional and advocacy perspective as well, because when advocates like myself and others from the organization encourage or speak to and this is groundbreaking and on all levels, particularly from someone who has lived it. I'm 14 years out. And so for me, I can speak more from a standpoint of I understand not only the emotional and physical perspective, but also the science behind how something like this is beneficial. And working from the standpoint of our organization that has a special interest in minority women, women of color, that cultural relevance and cultural responsiveness, I mean, it's key for the inclusion. The equality and equity, and it speaks to just inspiring these subgroups and this demographic to, number one, ask questions, two, get involved in clinical trials, and then not just get involved, but understand the significance behind whether or not you are represented in the trial. And so how the medicine potentially not just works for you, but also the legacy of the family.
Yeah, I'd like to chime there. I think, you know, Nadia makes an exceptional point. You know, as I mentioned kind of at the outset, African-American women, women of color, Black women are more likely to get triple negative breast cancer and unfortunately are very underrepresented in clinical trials across the United States. And so many of the conclusions that we make, whether it be from how well a drug works or even from the side effect standpoint, are really derived from a lot of data from many white women. And so I think, you know, in order for us to better understand how each population is impacted by drugs and what works best, having participation in these clinical trials to move things forward is absolutely critical.
And why has that been such a problem in the past, Nadia?
I think there's several factors. Speaking from a standpoint of being a woman of color and being in the community, I know that there are several things that are at play while not just about clinical trials, but getting treatment period or even just getting your annual screening. And this stems back to historical things, I believe. I think that the African-American community as a whole has seen and they've undergone some things in the past that have been edged in their minds that, I shouldn't do this, or I shouldn't participate, or I shouldn't ask questions, or not feeling that they will be treated adequately or equally. And these are things that are real to the community. And it's one of the reasons why advocacy is so important, so that folks that, number one, don't have a voice, we bring a voice. But then number two, we create a we create environments to get folks to act, you know. I think that the cultural relevance, and I talk a lot about that because it really does matter, and community and responsiveness, it makes our approach to these disparities specific and speaks to the culture as a whole, and not just, we're just talking to people, but we're specifically talking to the culture that has some systemic issues that they have faced that also overflow into healthcare, just to be completely honest with you. So I think that there's a duality to it. I do. I think there's a duality to it from the healthcare standpoint, but then also if you don't have a population that's represented because they won't come or they don't get involved, then you have... We have the problem that we have today that is represented in the numbers as far as the disparity is, as it is conjunction to white women, to black women being not just diagnosed with breast cancer, but dying from the disease.
And so what kind of information is available for those women right now? And how are you changing that by creating new ways to connect with them?
Well, from our standpoint, there are several other organizations. Also, the Red Alliance, I'm a board member there, who their arm is specifically in research and getting the African-American population involved in the research arm. Also, Pink Forever, we provide education and then also the resource to get there. But the biggest thing that we did, we provided a face. We provided a face to the disease that was different from what the community was showing, which was typically your 30 to 35 year old white woman. We started creating imagery so that folks could see themselves, that, hey, she looks like me, or that that could be my mother, that could be my sister, that could be my daughter. And it worked. It worked very well. It began to empower and inspire other individuals to want to tell their story and then come, hey, how can I participate? What can I do? And while it sounds so simple to provide imagery to it, back when I was diagnosed, which was back in 2007, I actually have to think about it now. I think that's pretty cool. Back in 2007, that there was not any information that was readily available to women of color that had faces on brochures, or when I went to receive my treatment, or I was in the hospital, there wasn't a pamphlet that looked like me on there. And so I think creating that imagery, because that's how the mind works. You know, it's a twofold situation. On one hand, the imagery that we created for the library, because it's the representation is a critical component. It also is how folks think in pictures, to be honest with you, that's how you think. And so we knew that it was something that was different, but then also the faces that were there, they were young women. I was 27 years old with a 2-year-old when I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so I couldn't see myself at 35 or 40 or 45. And then there's other women. I mean, I think the numbers, and Dr. Schneider or Radovich can help me with this, are significantly high for younger women under the age of 30 that are and have been diagnosed with breast cancer, but they couldn't see themselves because to them, you had to be older. You had to be older, and that this was not a disease that was impacting, it wasn't impacting Black women. And so we created a face to that, not just mine, but many, many, many others of all ages, all shapes and sizes, and colors, so that folks could see themselves, that, hey, that could be me. And not only that, that there's hope that you can also survive it as well, but you have to get active.
I think that, you know, you've hit upon several key things. One of the things that makes me curious is there a reason that you guys know that it is more prevalent among a certain population of women than, you know, both age and race, or do we not know?
Doctors?
Well, we don't. The simple answer is we don't completely know. We don't.
Okay.
We know a little bit when it comes to age because in a subset of patients, they inherit a mutation in a gene called BRCA1. BRCA1 mutations are inherited from mom or dad that predispose women in particular to breast and ovarian cancer, as well as also to some degree pancreatic cancer. And we know that women who carry BRCA1 mutations will be diagnosed at an earlier age. And if they do develop breast cancer, do develop triple negative breast cancer. When it comes to the race effect, it's something that is really under a huge amount of active investigation right now. We actually have a researcher at the IU Simon Cancer Center who's working with our Susan G. Komen Tissue Bank to really understand the biology of the normal breast, particularly in African-American women, and wanting to understand, is there a certain difference in the normal breast of women that predisposes them to triple negative? And he has some really interesting preliminary data on the role of adult stem cells in the normal breast and may predispose women to more aggressive triple negative. It's early data that it's probably best not to speak to it yet because it's still being fleshed out. But I think this is an area that we need to understand better and only be better understood by getting, as Nadia mentioned, more participation, more African-American women donating tissue, willing to volunteer, and this is how we're going to make headways.
You know, it's always, we have some of the, you know, risk factors well known for breast cancer, you know, over estrogen exposure, family history, carrying a specific gene, as Dr. Radovich alluded to, but the vast majority don't fit any of those criteria. And so there's a huge search to understand these, right? Because it's not until we understand these that we can start to think about ways to prevent it. So, you know, indeed, looking at and understanding the normal breast and the differences in different populations' breasts are going to be the key to this.
Wow. Nadia, what I was going to ask, too, is, you know, that your work with image, you know, the idea that you were talking about thinking in pictures, thinking visually. And I think we know the research on that's really high. I did a project with recently, a year ago, with IU School of Nursing on menopause. And our research was around the idea of something we don't talk about as well. So it was not only image, but it was the images we do portray, which are in comedy and other things that were negative images, which would cause women not to come forward and have those discussions. And so I think the work you're doing is critical in helping the doctors be able to do the research that they need, because if people don't come forward because they don't see themselves as at risk, then I think I've got exactly what you're talking about. And that's the real art, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that, When we were presented with the opportunity to work with Dr. Schneider and his team, it was for me as the president, it was like a light bulb went off. Like you don't see the marrying of the two, which and it's proven to I think more folks will catch on. You know, I think that medical institutions and advocacy groups or other organizations will come together to bridge that gap, because it is most important. And just with any other thing, people need to see themselves reflected in it. It's just like if you were to go somewhere, and we did this as a pilot one day, we put down different brochures and we had people walk in and out of the office, and the individuals picked up information that spoke to them or was reflected in how they either seen themselves or something that was a connection to them. Well, imagine there being life-saving information about clinical trials and about education and research, but you're not reflected in it. So you just pass it by. You don't even pick up things that are free, that are readily available and right in your face, because it's not speaking to you. So what one would think, and the subconscious helps this, that's a whole nother show, but this isn't for me. So I'm just going to keep going. And that's where the largest issue that we found is that things like what Dr. Radovich was talking about and Dr. Schneider about the Komen Tissue Bank, and even that information out there, we had to start putting people of color, women of color, Black women on the very marketing material. This is for me. I should do this, or even open it up and get into the inside of the pamphlet or the brochure to understand what it is, because they felt like, I'm reflected in this. This is for me. And so I think that it's actually brilliant. I mean, even that we're a part of it, I think that it's absolutely brilliant. And it's working, and people are starting to be very curious now. You know, even our patients that are going to, they're hearing about the different things that are going on. And I think Dr. Schneider said that, hey, can I get the blood test? But I feel like that's a door opening for the physician to explain more about what all of this is. And sometimes we just need somebody to crack the door, if you will, let us know it's okay to come in. And so even if the knock happens to be, can I get the blood test? I think it offers more of a platform to explain what the trial is and what your potential case or diagnosis or whatever is, for you to get some real sound information about that.
And I think this is where we need to explain to everyone that Dr. Schneider and Radovich, you were the two that decided, not only were you doing the science part of this research, but you needed that social input as well. So you reached out to create what is truly a photo library and videos aimed at bringing in women of color to this. Why was that so important to you? And why has something like that not been done before?
Well, you know, speaking for both myself and Dr. Radovich, you know, we're both, we try to be really good at science. We're science geeks, and I try to take really good care of my patients. I'm not good at a lot of things, and this is one of them. You know, I think we realized we don't understand the optimal ways of, you know, reaching out to different communities. And, you know, real credit to Casey Bales, who works with us as a program manager. You know, she's kept a really good tab on where we were doing well and where we were lagging. And I think she really helped guide us to be fortunate enough to really get a meet, Nadia and Lisa. And, you know, that introduction was a real game changer for us in terms of understanding what we weren't doing well and how we can make things better. And it's been a blessing to us. And I agree with Nadia's comment before. I think when you look at this sort of success, it's hard to imagine others won't be trying to replicate it.
I hope so. Well, we're going to continue our conversation here with Dr. Brian Schneider and Dr. Milan Radovich and Nadia Miller. We're discussing the art and science of this new breast cancer research and the ways that they're reaching out into the community to help more people. We want to remind you that our program is made possible by the generosity of an anonymous donor who supports the Da Vinci Pursuits mission of creating a museum without walls so that artists, scientists, and the community can come together for unique activities and conversations. And we're going to continue ours in just a moment.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artist Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR, The Diamond.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Rock and roll has evolved over the years from a sound that shaped the youth of a nation.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, the crying old time.
To an era that started a rebellion.
We're the rebel, yeah. She's my mom,
Or even bringing in a brand new generation. Every week on After Dark, we look through the songs and the stories that shaped rock and roll as we know it today.
After Dark, Sundays at 1 a.m. on 88.7 WICR.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope. Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're talking about new research when it comes to what we just learned about is a triple negative breast cancer. Our guests are IU School of Medicine researchers Dr. Milan Radovich and Dr. Brian Schneider, and the board president of Pink Forever, Nadia Miller. And, you know, I just find this whole idea of the connections between how we perceive ourselves to be so interesting into whether it's, you know, it's exciting when we think about the genetic research, what we're discovering from all that. It's exciting when we get to treatment plans that help save lives. But what to me in this whole conversation is really interesting is how we get people to come forward so that we actually are getting a reasonable sample of individuals so that we know how to do that treatment and that we can refine what we do genetically. And, you know, it strikes me over and over again how often that doesn't happen. I was wondering in this case, are women like a lot of men we know that have had something like a heart attack or they know that they have heart disease and they don't want to seek treatment because not of their image, but because they just are afraid to find the information out?
Nadia, what are your experiences with women that are involved in your organization that way?
Well, I mean, the fear factor, and that's exactly what it is actually one of those things I was talking about before, that there's multiple things that kind of play a role in the why behind the impact of the disease, specifically with people, period, but with African Americans in particular, and just being afraid. It's almost, you know, if you it would be anything, if you're afraid to go to the dentist and you never have went, you find that someone's 50 years old and they've never went to just have an annual cleaning, or, you know, men who have a certain age, they don't get their annual checks or their prostate, or women, same thing. And I think that what advocacy does and what creating environments for this is to talk about that very thing. Like, it's okay to talk about these things. And in the conversation, and the why behind the detriment of not doing. And it also helps, I think, presenting people, not just like myself. There are a lot of advocates out here or individuals who have, they can speak from a seat that I've gone through it. And so it diminishes the fear factor a little bit that breast cancer is not a death sentence. And, you know, we can speak to that, but then we also get to speak to how we overcame that by following through with the continuum of care. And that the first step is getting there, but the fear factor absolutely plays a part in the numbers. There's no doubt about it. And even specifically around clinical trials as well, there's a fear factor there. And, you know, just to be completely transparent, you know, if you talk to African-American men or women and you talk about trials or you talk about experiments and things like that's the first thing that comes to their mind is something that happened with the Tuskegee Airmen. They're immediately the syphilis story is the first thing that someone they're talking about that today in 2020. That's still at the forefront of people's minds. And then you have the generational thing that kicks in that grandma told the granddaughter has now told the cousin. Now everybody is afraid, right? And so I think a lot of our jobs as well to get folks involved in clinical trials because of the fear factor is to break down and dispel some of those myths and provide a comfortability to go along with it so that it's okay to go. But there absolutely the fear factor is probably, I would say, number two, if not almost number one, to not get involved in whatever capacity that means, whether that means screening, whether that's clinical trials, whether that is just being proactive in your healthcare, the fear factor absolutely plays a role in that.
So how did you help push through that fear factor with these women, recruiting them to be literally the faces that are representing within the videos that are being produced and the photography library that is making a huge difference? How did you let them know that this was the right thing to do and they were going to be taken care of?
Well, there is definitely within the African-American community, there is a trust. There's trust issues. And so they trust me. I mean, it's as bare bones as that, not just me, but the individuals that look like me. You know, Lisa Hayes is the executive director of the Red Alliance, who we run together neck and neck. And we had to get very personal very quickly and then start galvanizing the community around. Here are two individuals, and then it became four, and then it became 100, and then it became 300 women that trusted what we said about this particular institution. And then they begin to see us together. They begin to see videos. They begin to see Dr. Schneider and his team. And we were all together working towards this one cause, which is to get you involved to, number one, give you the information, but to save your life or potentially expand whatever, because I don't know what the cases are, to for you to have the best quality of care that you could have. And so it was a trust issue. We got together and we started being seen together. And while it sounds simple, I know that's not really the norm. And we began to walk alongside one another and say the same things and encourage the same way and have events together where Dr. Schneider and his team would come and speak and teach to these very people. And so then those people began to trust. And so we developed the trust with the community is how it happened.
So I think in a clinical setting for both of you as doctors, this goes right to the heart of, you can't have a relationship, a medical relationship, without having the social, emotional relationship with your patient.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think, you know, as Nadia elegantly pointed out, I mean, fear is a really important human emotion, and we all experience it. And the interesting thing is, I think if we make assumptions as to why someone is afraid, you're often going to be wrong.
Right.
And so part of, you know, my job is to start out by saying, what is it that you fear? And it's often very different than what you would expect it to be. Maybe someone is afraid of hair loss. Maybe another person is afraid they won't be able to take care of their child. Maybe another feels they will lose autonomy. But until you understand that fear, you really can't help reassure them that it's going to be okay, or that you're going to be able to do things to get around that. But, you know, the truth is, you can't even start to work through those issues if the patient doesn't come see you. And so, you know, I think the work that Lisa and Nadia have done has been incredibly important to, you know, earn the trust of the patients to say, hey, get out and let's start talking through these things. And until that happens, you know, you're not going to make any progress.
Well, yeah, that's what I wondered too. What has the reaction been, Nadia, for both for the women involved in your project and then those women being involved in your projects, doctors?
Well, as far as the women, the imagery and the it has been a very, very positive response. To be honest, we are super duper busy with creating this library and it because the images tell a story for for them, and I feel and this is my humble opinion through conversations also afterwards, because in our opinion here at Pink Forever, the currency in life is really relationships. So I take time to know about you. I take time to understand you, just to be exactly what Dr. Schneider said, like you have to get to know them. And so what has happened is there has been a really positive response to how can I get involved? How can I tell my story as far as with my image? We have, and triple negative, to be honest with you, is a huge thing. Most of the breast cancer survivors that I know in my personal world are triple negative breast cancer survivors. And so it's this relationship that we have forged is something that I didn't imagine that it's something like this would take shape and take place, but it has been very positive in how we will move forward. Number one, what the future looks like is very promising. And then number two, more women are coming to number one, get involved proactively. And that's what I have really been excited about, to get involved proactively with the tissue bank and proactively in clinical trials that may be newly diagnosed patients so that they can get the information. So it's been a very positive response.
Yeah, Dr. Radovich, I want to go back just for a second to some of the science of this. One of the interesting things, and you both mentioned it at the beginning, was what's beginning to come out of all that work we did on the genome. And, you know, it's incredibly complicated in humans and huge. But at the same time, I think there's been leaps in our technology, computing technology, that have helped. Are you seeing a day when those things that are we know to be genetically caused, that we may be able to actually intervene at the genetic level?
I hope. I really do. You know, I think due to advances, as we mentioned, genomic technology, but also in computation, it takes huge supercomputers these days to analyze all this data.
It does.
But I do hope that we will be able to not just know which folks are at high risk of their cancer coming back, but also be able to prevent it from happening in the first place. And I think this is an area of research that is really, really hot right now, which is this concept of what can we do to mitigate disease occurrence. When it comes to circulating tumor technology, actually a really neat study was just presented at our national conference about a month ago, was that the same technology we use to detect relapse can be used also for early detection of cancer. And so this was a huge 100,000 volunteer study published showing the power of using circulating tumor DNA essentially to be able to detect cancers early. And this is important because what we know is if we detect it early, we can really improve outcomes, right? When you catch a cancer at its earliest stages, those patients have the best chances. And so my hope is that we will be continuing to harness this technology to really move what we call stage shifts, but move the bar by catching these cancers earlier.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I think, you know, one of the things we've been talking about that's so important is getting people to come, filling their image, having support, like you're talking about from other women. But the other side is the advance in being what we can do on the other end. And, you know, I was struck by this entire conversation, how hard it would be to go the praise and joy that I would have that I'm free of the cancer, and then all of a sudden to realize it might still be lying underneath somewhere and coming back, and how difficult living that way, because we only have a little sample ourselves, like I do with COVID. You know, if I'm coughing, most people now, you know, have a little feel for what you're talking about. Am I sick? But and that same thing has to be there. Am I going to die? You know, or is this going to come back again? And that comes from the hope you're talking about in the science. In other words, if we can make these things that you guys are doing work, then we have a double hope. We get them into the study, and then we can actually do something.
Well, and as you because there have been more treatments made available to extend the lives of those with breast cancer. To me, that's the most important part of knowing this, to kind of give you a ballpark in your mind. How much time do I have before it's probably going to come back? Because it's going to come back. But that it's so much more of a relief that way. And it also gives you the hope. And I'm guessing that these results will help future treatments as well.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I mean, so the only part I'll disagree with is I hope there is a day where we can actually say it ain't going to come back, because our therapies are so good. We know it's high risk of coming back, but we understand the vulnerability in this tumor. And now we got a great drug to target it. So we're going to, you know, squash it now. So, but no, I agree with you. I mean, I think technology that allows us to predict things sometimes gives us news we don't want to hear, but until we understand the truth, we really can't start to approach the problem in a way where we can try to fix it. And I think that's kind of where we are in this battle right now.
That is kind of the whole purpose of science. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we're at a moment too, and which I think is positive. There's still a lot of negative around it, but we're in a moment where science is finding a resurgence among the public, a little more trust. I think people like Dr. Fauci and others continue to be kind of the voices of reason and science in that. And so I think it goes to exactly what you're saying, Brian, with this idea that, you know, I think people will begin again to feel that science is going to give some answers to the really deep questions that we have, and look to that rather than maybe some of our false sources in the past, which, you know, were people trying to peddle something that wasn't real. And so I think this is wonderful.
Yeah, I agree. You know, when science is done properly, there is actually nothing, I think, more pure and beautiful. It's not biased. It really answers questions in a way that's meaningful. And so science done right is the most gorgeous thing on the planet.
I agree.
And then that obviously that does completely coincide with the visual aspect of it here too. Yep. And having seen some of the photographs, Nadia, that are in this collection, they are beautiful. They are very personal stories that are being told that automatically make someone who is afraid not be as fearful and want to take part and want to be a part of it. You've done a wonderful job. The photographers that have been involved in this project, where did you find them?
About 10, 11 years ago, my personal Nadia story, when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, I wanted to capture for myself, speaking to what everyone has been talking about tonight with triple negative breast cancer. I did not know if I was going to live, and I had a 2-year-old daughter, and I wanted to capture imagery of myself and leave for her, to be honest. And I found a photographer, her name is Tasha Cannon, Cannon Styled Imagery. And when she took my 5-year photo, she captured the essence of just how I felt, and just, it was strong, but it was vulnerable, and it was something that I was proud of. And that was 5 years ago. And so we use a very specific photographer that also holds the integrity of the person that they're in front of, because it's not easy to take photos, believe it or not. I know the images are so beautiful, but there's a lot of time that goes into that comfortability of a woman in front of a camera who is in treatment. A lot of those images that you see, women are in treatment, or women have just had bilateral mastectomies. They've had their breast removed, or they still have their ports. And so I found this photographer by a personal journey of my own, and her and her company were gracious enough to expand and say, hey, I'm willing to do whatever you need us to do, because I believe in, you know, what you all are doing. And so here we are 14 years later with her, and she's still shooting for us. And it's a really when you look at the photos, and I talk about the essence of it, it's not just sitting down and the lady's taking a photo. And so this is a person that actually cares about the patients, and you can see it in her work, I think. I think you can see it in her work.
I agree. And that's why I wanted to bring that up, because I mean, there's a huge difference between just a static, sterile picture of somebody in an office. Nobody wants to get involved in that. And nowadays, so many of us, we're so much used to pictures of everything with our phone. Everybody takes pictures all the time. So we're used to seeing more arty styled pictures and more real and true pictures. And it brings us closer to people. And that's exactly how these images are presented. And am I understanding that there is a possibility of them being shared with other places as well, with the Vera Bradley Foundation is possibly getting involved too?
Yeah, so I can't speak exactly to that. We've obviously had a really close partnership with the Vera Bradley Foundation, and I think they are very interested in really painting a diverse picture of breast cancer. So I'm sure those conversations are ongoing, but I would love to share my scientific view of one of the stories of the pictures. So again, I'm a very non-artsy person, and I'm very reliant and humbled by the people who are great at this. But, you know, some of the pictures that we used obviously had to be approved by a variety of different groups. And one of them in particular showed a woman with a low-cut shirt with cleavage and a tattoo, very powerful. And, you know, the initial feedback was, this is too risque. It's just not appropriate. And, you know, all credit to Nadia and Casey and Lisa saying, no, this is what patients need to see. And, you know, ultimately being persistent, they accepted it. And again, that was one of the most highly acclaimed, I think, photos of all. And now, you know, based on this, you know, Casey has been asked to talk to, you know, our entire cooperative group across North America about how to really do this well. And again, it's all because of really sharing the expertise of Nadia and Lisa and understanding what that vision should look like.
Yeah, that's the other part of this, is there's so much that other researchers and organizations can learn by this really unique partnership that you all have developed here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting here as a former museum professional and thinking how badly we, over the years, have done health exhibits. You know, a giant walk through heart, well, big deal. And so my thing that you're doing here is you're really truly using the art forms of people and of making them more personal to do that. And I think we have a lot to learn from the examples that you all are using about how we really address both the science and what I'd call the art of people. And that social side. And Jill was mentioning, you know, anybody can take a picture with a camera. Well, they can, but not everybody can take a picture of the real soul of that person. That takes a professional, or takes somebody who has trust in the person that's there.
What is next for your trials and your research, doctors?
Well, you know, I think this conversation on diversity is so fascinating, because it really dovetails with what Dr. Schneider and I are passionate about, which is this concept of personalized medicine. And the way most drugs are advanced in cancer is based on the average response or the average patient. But the reality is, there's no such thing as an average patient. Everybody's unique and different. Their DNA makes them different. And even in the tumors, their DNA is really, really different. And so Dr. Schneider and I have been really passionate, really dedicated our research careers to understanding these unique differences and how do we tailor therapy to those individual differences. And so our next step is going to be our new trial. It's going to be called the PERSEVERE trial. This trial will open later this year, early next year. And we'll specifically enroll women again with triple negative breast cancer who have residual disease after neoadjuvant chemotherapy. But this time we're going to stratify women by the presence of this circulating DNA after surgery or not. And if they are positive for the circulating tumor DNA, as we mentioned, they're at high risk of relapse, we're actually going to match a genomic therapy, so a therapy that's specifically designed to the unique makeup of that tumor, where we'll give the patient that additional therapy after surgery. If they are negative for this marker, they'll be for the ctDNA, their physician will have the choice of choosing a particular standard chemotherapy we call capecitabine, or maybe even choosing not to do any therapy and consider de-escalating.
Wow.
This is all very exciting, and we're excited to hear about this. We're just about out of time, but Nadia, if more women wanted to get involved in your project, how do they get a hold of you?
They can contact us at area code 317-682-4944, or they can go to our website at pink4ever.org.
Well, thank you. And thank you all of our guests today, Nadia Miller with Pink Forever and IU School of Medicine researchers, Dr. Milan Radovich and Dr. Brian Schneider. We appreciate your time today so much.
Thanks for having us.
And you'll find pictures of the projects and those of other guests on our website, as well as links, Nadia, that you were just talking about, and to the DaVinciPursuit.com, where we create museums without walls, so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
And until our next conversation, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to stay curious.
Stay curious.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on the DaVinciPursuit.com. Or you could join Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling every Saturday live on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.